Okay. So far, so good. We got the microphone to work. So, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Hope you're feeling pretty good. I got my watch here. It's wonderful to start to have this session together with you. And I particularly like this moment in the session because I get to be, you know, out of my cage, out of my little room, although I love seeing you in there. During the next few days, I want to take us back to some of the original ideas that are found in early Buddhism. Because they're very relevant to our lives and to our world right now. And after a while of practice, we sort of hear these ideas wherever we go, but they don't necessarily really get explored. And I think that, in particular, my thought was that we've reached such a really toxic situation in the world that we need to go back to the source. We need to go back to some really fundamental exploration and investigation and understanding, because most of the people I speak to these days are pretty distressed, angry, hurt, confused, scared, the whole thing. And the early Buddhists were pretty smart, it turns out. They understood this whole upside down circus of human life with great clarity and with great precision. And so I thought I'd start with, this is a very brief story from what's called the 100 Parable Sutra, about 1,700 years ago. And Kaz Ta-Nehisi and I translated this 100 Parable Sutra. And all the stories in the sutra are about fools. And so they managed to show us ourselves in certain light, certain ways. And these are moral tales, so they all come with a moral at the end. A long time ago, there was a very wealthy man who was a great fool. It was hard to say which was the greater, his wealth or his lack of understanding. I can hear you already applying this. One day, he went to visit another wealthy man, and when he arrived, he was amazed to see that a tower had been built, 3 stories high. It was very tall and wide, with broad eaves and large windows on every side, and the foolish man gaped at it enviously. He had never seen such a grand and a beautiful tower before. He began to think, I have as much money as this man. In fact, I have more money. I should have a tower like that. So he returned home, and he sent for a carpenter without delay. When the carpenter arrived, the wealthy fool told him about the other man's tower, and then rather testily he said, "Well, can you build me a tower as grand as that or not?" The carpenter answered modestly, "Sir," he said, "I built that tower, so I'm sure I could build you one." "Then what are you standing here for?" said the man. "Get to work." "Good boss, eh?" The carpenter did as he was told. He measured the land, gathered his tools and materials, and began to lay bricks for the tower's foundation. When the fool saw him laying the bricks, he became suspicious. "What in the world is he doing?" he thought. He ran up to the carpenter and shouted, "Just what do you intend to make here, I'd like to know?" The carpenter was a bit confused, and he said, "I'm making a 3-story tower, sir, just as you asked." "Well, forget the bottom 2 stories, the rich fool said. "I don't want them. Just make the top story for me right away." The carpenter looked at him amazed and said, "Sir, how can I not build a 1st story, but build a 2nd? And how could I not build a 2nd story, but build a 3rd? The rich fool was not convinced. "I already told you," he said, "I don't need those bottom stories. I only want the top story. So do as I say or get out of my sight." When people heard this, they scratched their heads and they couldn't stop laughing. "What a fool he is," they said. "How could someone have the top story of a tower without first building the ones below?" So this is, a story about someone who wants the fruit of practice, but doesn't want to do the things he has to do in order to get the fruit of practice, right? He just wants the top story. And he didn't have what else is in the story is he doesn't have a genuine aspiration for practice. He's motivated by envy. And so that envy leads him to a kind of greed or a kind of craving that doesn't make any sense at all. So it's a very foolish kind of thing right from the beginning. So what our aspiration is very important. And understanding how it works is important. So one of the ideas, as you know, that transferred from Hinduism to Buddhism is the idea of karma. And there's been a lot of talk about karma. And karma just means action, basically, cause and effect. But one way to understand karma is that everything that we do in our lives is an expression of our understanding in that moment. It's as far as we've gotten to. And sometimes parts of us are more dominant and sometimes other parts are more dominant or less dominant. But everything that we do is an expression of our understanding in the present. And based on that understanding, our actions today plant a seed that affects our lives and that affects the world now and in the future. So we should understand that we're living karma now. We're creating karma now. We're creating cause and effect at every point. And recently at one of our Wednesday night sittings, I spoke about how when we walk during Kinhin, which you've been doing a couple of times now at this retreat, when our body and mind are really at one with each other, when there's really no gap, when body and mind are really an integrated, just one thing happening, which is why I say put your mind in your foot and don't miss a single thing. That's a complete expression of our being in that moment. And as our foot presses into the floor, it's as if we're planting a Buddha seed in the earth because body and mind are together. So it's an awakened step. It's not just a step. It's a realized step. It's an awakened step. So that's like a Buddha seed. And when we plant the Buddha seed in the earth, that Buddha seed will grow into Buddha fruit in the future, unlike what this foolish man was trying to do. So our walking today in Kinhin, and actually everything that we do at Sesshin, every single thing that we do, whether we're walking or chanting or eating or sitting or going to the toilet or whatever it is, everything we do and how we do it can be seen as karma at work. Most people tend to think of karma as something that they got from the back. But actually, it's right now. And it's something that we really should understand. We are always creating. We are always the cause of some effect. And so the depth of our understanding becomes very important once we understand that. We know, for example, that a watermelon seed can only come from a watermelon. And if we plant a watermelon, a seed, you know what will grow. A watermelon will grow. So that's sort of obvious. So in a way, the seed that we plant brings us back to the source of the seed in that way. If there was no watermelon, there's no watermelon seed, and you know, et cetera, like that. So the same is true with all seeds, including Buddha seeds. We have Buddha seeds inside of us already because we are already Buddhas. This is basic to our understanding. We are all already awakening beings. That's what a Buddha is. Waking up to our own true being, or our own original self. And when we plant these seeds of awakening now in how we go about our lives and how we go about doing things and practice in a way so that these seeds are really good, strong seeds, it strengthens our experience of, and it strengthens our confidence in our wholeness, in the fact that we are Buddhas. It strengthens it. It makes it more strong. And this wholeness is sometimes called a Buddha nature. And I've talked about this a number of times, but I really want to say developing confidence in the fact that we are already whole, in the fact that we are Buddhas awakening to our Buddha nature, is very important for building a strong foundation in our lives. Because it's in that realization that we finally get to realize that it's not this dualistic subject-object world, but actually this whole world is included right here, and that we share this with every single thing that is sentient and growing in the world. So we just ate our first oryoki meal at Sesshin. I hope you enjoyed oryoki. And those of you who have come before know that I feel this way, that I believe that Oryoki practice is Buddha in a bowl. That's it. That the whole of the practice is right there in Oryoki. And one of the things I haven't said to you, though, is that we can think of Oryoki as a practice that embodies the middle path of Mahayana teaching. Oryoki really is the middle path. Not too much, not too little, not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold, just the right amount of everything. That's Oryoki practice. And any of you, if you took too much food and ended up with a big glob at the end, you know what too much really, now you know what too much means, right? But so this, just the right amount, that's what our practice is all about in Oryoki. But what I think is really important for us to realize is that when we bring the understanding of Oryoki to the rest of our lives, and we practice just the right amount in the rest of our lives, because that's the middle way of the Mahayana path, we can actually diminish and even end suffering through that practice alone, through the practice of Oryoki in the world. In early Buddhist terminology, it can help us get off the wheel of birth and death, which is called samsara, and which we stay on because we're controlled by what are called the three poisons. The Sanskrit word for the three poisons is trivisa. That sort of makes sense, trivisa. So this is really the nitty-gritty, because I'm watching the world being torn to pieces by the three poisons. And in Buddhist teachings, these three poisons are considered the three fundamental afflictions, absolutely fundamental afflictions, that keep us trapped in samsara. There's not three others. These three poisons, they're also sometimes called unwholesome roots. They're said to be the root of all the other afflictions, these three. Everything, whatever affliction you have, can be traced back to these three poisons in a Buddhist understanding. And these, of course, these afflictions cloud the mind, and they cause us to take unwholesome action, which creates, you know, the kind of world that we have. Because a lot of the people who are in charge of stuff right now are really at the behest of these three poisons. One of the things that's important to know is that these three poisons are the source of the attachments and aversions that are referred to in the second ennobling truth. So the first one, right, life is dukkha. So life is difficult or suffering or dissatisfactory or kind of utsiness about it, you know, not so great. And the second ennobling truth is that the reason is because of our own afflictions, our own attachments and aversions. And those are the first two noble truths of the Buddha. And the three poisons are, in fact, the source of those attachments and aversions. So I think it's very important that we look at these with great clarity in our lives. So you probably know that the three poisons are greed, and then hatred or ill will, and or aggression, aversion. So greed, hatred, and ill will, and delusion or ignorance. As many of you know, in our practice, we have something called the Atonement Gatha, or the verse of atonement. And it says, all my ancient twisted karma. I want to let you know this. The character that's been translated as twisted, like, God, he's really twisted. That's not what the character means. It actually means twisting or entangling. And if you think about the way karma works, you'll see how that is. We say, all my ancient twisting karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. All of that karma. And this acknowledgement of all the things that have gone into creating the kind of suffering that we endure and maybe cause us to cause some kind of harm in the world, this avowal, this acknowledgement is meant to purify us from the effect of acting on the three poisons. And so when we chant this before receiving precepts and vows, or at Fusatsu when we're renewing our precepts and vows, this is our chance to sort of acknowledge. It's called atonement, which means at one minute, take it into ourselves. I acknowledge this. And then sort of levels the playing field. We can start again. So it's a kind of act of, it's an act of repentance and renewal when we do that. So I want to spend the next few days talking, as I said, about these three poisons and looking at them so we can really understand some of the dynamics of each one so that, you know, it'll help diminish any of the discomfort or the suffering that we feel and that also we put out there on the world. We can't change everything that we face or look at, but there's no chance to change anything if we don't face it and we don't look at it. So I'm going to ask that you join me in making a very deep investigation of these three poisons in our life as an act of awareness and as an act of compassion for ourselves and for the world. I think it's good news for us to take a look at these poisons, because otherwise they run like toxic underground rivers in our lives, and we don't even know why we're saying and doing and feeling and thinking and acting the way we are. And in a way, the poisons are so familiar to us that we don't recognize them as poisons at all. We do all kinds of fancy thinking with that. But I was very cheered to come upon a quote of Pema Chodron, who I'm sure most of you know who she is. She said, "The most fundamental aggression and harm that we can do to ourselves is to not have the courage and the respect to look at ourselves honestly and gently." That's quite a statement. The most aggressive thing we can do is to not know ourselves. I think that's pretty good, I have to say. So I had some fun. I made a visual representation of the three poisons. There you go. This is from a very old Chinese painting. And you can see there's a pig, and there's a young rooster called a cockerel, and there's a snake. And it may surprise you, but if I said, okay, which one represents greed, what would you say? The pig. No. For some reason, and this is something I really want to contemplate, the pig represents ignorance, represents delusion. And the cockerel, the young rooster, represents greed. Because greed in Buddhist, I'm kind of waving, greed in Buddhist understanding is really based on the sensual world. It's based on the six senses. So we, you know, the senses get excited, and then all of a sudden we get all greedy and things like that. And then hatred or ill will is related, or aversion is the snake. So what do you see going on here? They're chasing each other, right? They're chasing each other. They're going around and around and around in a circle, which means that they're attached to each other through their consuming self-destructive appetites. They feed each other, in other words. And therefore, the wheel of samsara just keeps spinning around and around and around. Greed feels hatred. It feeds hatred. Hatred feeds delusion. Delusion feeds greed. And around it goes. So I think we're going to look at these unwholesome roots, these poisons. And I want to make sure that as we consider some of the ways that they may affect our lives, that we do it in a way that just bears witness to them and avoids any negative judgments about ourselves, if we happen to find, possibly. Even though we are Buddhas, some mild trace of the three poisons in our lives. But we shouldn't judge ourselves for it, because it's just part of being human. And also, one of the things you should know is that negative judgment is derived from one of the three poisons. So every time you're kind of putting yourself down, that's an alarm bell. I am eating poison. We need to be able to say that to ourselves quickly. We need to be able to recognize it very quickly so we don't make ourselves toxic with our lack of understanding, basically. So we always want to have the antidotes of compassion and awareness helping us as we're looking at ourselves. And I'm going to say that over and over again because this is it's toxic stuff. It's hot stuff, and we should know about it. You know, having a kind of kind-hearted clarity and discernment is the only way, really, for us to make an investigation of how we function as people. We must be very kind to ourselves. We are just poor, suffering beings. And fortunately, because we have a human birth, we have the capacity to develop awareness so that we can end that suffering. And that's something that's very important for us to realize. So, since I'm talking about it so much, let's start with greed. And because, of course, the newspapers are having a field day with greed. Another way to think of greed is a kind of overabundant attachment or clinging or kind of grasping. And when I thought about, okay, where does greed come from? At least part of it, greed is based on this deeply seated conviction that who we are and what we are and what we have is just simply not enough. It's not just the right amount, right? It's the opposite of that. And this comes from a deeply held belief, and it's only a belief, that we are lacking something. And so we constantly feel that we need to have more. And the problem is that once greed is activated, there's never enough more, as you may know. There's always something else to get. There's always something else to be. There's always something else to have. There was someone who came to Sashin here many years ago, and he said, I suffer from, FOMS. I said, FOMS? That sounds very serious. What is it? He said, fear of missing something. I said, oh, I thought it was fear of myself. And he said, that's why I came to Sashin. But we should know that it comes from this deeply held belief that, you know, we're missing something, and so greed just keeps seeking more, and the more it seeks, the more it spreads, because it's poison, right? It spreads into other areas of our lives that may have nothing to do with what started it out. So we want more food, we want more praise, we want more money, we want more sex, we want more power, we want more control. But what's interesting, if you just look at that list that I just mentioned, is that in just the right amount, there's nothing wrong with wanting food. And there's nothing wrong with wanting some encouragement, maybe in the form of praise. And there's nothing wrong with wanting enough money to pay our bills so we don't create a problem for ourselves and our family and create a problem for the person who we bought something from or who did service for us. There's nothing wrong with wanting a close, loving, intimate, possibly sexual relationship. There's nothing wrong with wanting to direct our lives into some wholesome areas. But the thing is that greed is not based on addressing any of these real life concerns. Greed has nothing to do with the very simple fact of the things that we need in order to live our lives. It's based on demands that cannot be satisfied. That's the key to greed. Because greed arises from one of the six realms of existence in the Buddhist cosmology. And you know what it is. It's the realm of the preta, the realm of the hungry ghost. And so for those of you who don't know, hungry ghosts are beings that they can never be satisfied. They have huge bellies and throats the width of a needle. So no matter how much you feed them and how often you feed them and no matter what what you feed them, they can never be satisfied. Like this. This is my little hungry ghost. So I thought my Dharma talk would be like an art project or something. But that's what they look like, you can see. This is what we have that's actually kind of, we're carrying it around with us. So we need to know that when we're attacked by greed or grasping or craving or some kind of overabundant attachment, trying to satisfy it will never work. because it cannot be. The seeds of our greed, and the seeds of all greed, are usually planted at a very early age, and then they're nourished in our environment, usually in our family environment. They're part of the inheritance that we receive from all the factors that go into creating and forming what we are. And because of interdependence, because of the interdependent nature of life, you know, the ebb and flow of life and everything kind of mixing in together, we're not the only ones who create what we are. So there is an inheritance from our personal or our family life. There's inheritance from our DNA and then the way that we were raised and the values that we were given and the lessons that we were taught. That's part of our inheritance that helps cause greed. And then there's also a cultural inheritance that affects us and that puts ideas in our minds. And then there's a historical inheritance. So all of these things together go into creating the kind of greed or the grasping or clutching or clinging that we might experience. And that's one of the reasons, because of all these different inheritances, it's one of the reasons that the Atonement verse says, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. It isn't just something we made. We have entered a larger river of greed, hate, and delusion. And that's part of why it's really, really hard to get out of that river, because this stream has been going, as far as I know, for as long as human beings have been going. And nothing has done anything to clarify the water in that stream except spiritual practice. So there is a kind of good sign. If we look gently at ourselves, and it's probably true, the greed seed for the people in this room is probably not very large. I'm not saying you don't have it, because I'm sure you do. I'm sure everybody's got some clinging and attachment, grasping, clutching, begging, you know, in some way. But when it's large, it can really be experienced as a huge hole inside of us, because we feel or believe that we've received an insufficient amount of something essential. Insufficient amount of something very, very important. It could be the lack of receiving love when we were little. It could be the result of not receiving a decent amount of encouragement and attention in our formative years, when we're so tender and that's all we really want is someone to say good. Maybe we didn't get that. It could be the lack of acceptance, because other people see us as other. Maybe we're the wrong color, or we're the wrong religion, or we're the wrong gender, or we have the wrong color eyes, or maybe, you know, we're in a family where everyone plays sports but you. And that lack of acceptance can be very painful and very, very hard to deal with. And it also could be something quite practical, like not having enough money to provide food and shelter and clean clothing, which can lead to a deep anxiety and a kind of grasping in people. And, you know, I'm of the age who got to talk to a lot of people who grew up during the Great Depression, including my family, and they made that very, very clear. Why are you so nervous, Mom? Well, you never know when everything will disappear. It was explicit. So my mother suffered from deep anxiety her whole life, because they were so poor during the Depression that they were put out on the street. They didn't have food. They didn't have good. And it wasn't just like they were not picking on my mother's family. I mean, this is the way things were for many, many people. So one of the things that we should know is that whatever the cause of the grasping or clutching that we feel, greed tends to be pretty self-justifying and therefore defensive. It's very hard, I'm going to warn you about this, it's very hard for us to really say, yes, my attachment is too strong, because those attachments, they like themselves very, very much. They're very toxic in that way, and they'll argue for their own existence. They will do that. And sometimes, sadly, we suffer even more because there's shame attached to greed. Somewhere we know, I shouldn't do this, and then we do it anyway. So these feelings and beliefs that we have of lack tend to get translated into wants, and then I want to be loved, or I want to be accepted, or I want to be fed, or I want to be famous, or I want to. And when our wants are not genuinely addressed, and by genuinely addressed, I mean as adults, we have to face what's happening inside of us so that we can take care of it with our own awareness and our own compassion. That's how you genuinely address these things. When they're not genuinely addressed, the want turns into a need, and the need can grow into this unquenchable hunger and thirst and demand. And then it runs our lives. One of the things that I found interesting when I was contemplating the subject of greed is that because of all the factors that create craving, there's another good word, that create craving in a person, it could be very hard to find the source of that craving, because there are so many elements that go into it. And this is especially true when greed shows up in a form far from its source. So, for example, maybe we didn't feel loved, and so our life is driven to get money and power and fame. I didn't feel loved. I want to be famous. It's very hard to trace that back instantly in ourselves. But that craving will come from some source. And if we didn't get enough nourishment of some kind, then we want constant approval and encouragement from somewhere else in the world. It's, it's very common. So it takes a lot of discernment for us to really know what we are and know what people are and how we got to be the way we got to be. But the thing that I think is really, really great, really encouraging, is that we don't really need to find the source of greed or attachment in order to work with it. We actually can use our practice to take care of what's right in front of us. And if what's right in front of us is kind of craving or grasping or something like that, there is a practice to take care of it. We can bring this devouring self and all of its appetites that separates us from ourselves and from everybody else. Because, as soon as you get into that subject-object thing, I have to have, well, what if they get it? No, I got to get it. We're hopelessly lost. But we can practice the antidote to the poisons. And the antidote to greed is found in the six paramitas, the six perfections. And it's the very first one. Do you want to take a guess on what it is?
Generosity.
Exactly right. Dana. Generosity. Generosity, and along with it, the ability to accept our situation as things are. So generosity and non-attachment or contentment. So for all that attachment of grasping, generosity, and finding a way to be content with our situation. Looking at it honestly and seeing, okay, maybe I don't have that, but how are things here? I'm alive. Well, that's a good start. Really looking deeply. Sincere generosity or giving and having a kind of greater equanimity with our situation is a very profound and a very beautiful form of gratitude. We don't usually think of generosity as gratitude, but if you look at it, it is. And we don't think of finding a way to be content with our situation as gratitude, but actually it is. And it will increase the gratitude if we really come to terms. Things are okay, so I don't have that. Fine. I will never play professional basketball. But I'm waking up every day. In the training that we received at the temple during Oryoki at lunch, we would take one grain of rice from the Buddha bowl. So that Buddha bowl, for those of you who are new to it, that contains only grain. And so it's the best food. It's the Buddha's bowl. It's the food of awakening. So we would take one grain of rice from the Buddha bowl and we would feed the hungry ghosts with it. We'd consciously choose to feed the hungry ghosts. And we would say, all unwholesome spirits, now I give you this offering. This food will pervade everywhere. And even though it's just a grain of rice, because of our intention, because of our conscience, our conscious aspiration and desire that that food does go everywhere with us. Later in the day, when one of the hungry ghosts would show up, because they, you know, they do, they follow us around, you know, we would say, oh, nice to see you. Good to see you. Yeah, I know you're hungry. I fed you. You already ate today. And then we don't strengthen it by letting it consume our time or our energy or our attention or our confidence or activity. The conversation is over. We just go back to what we were doing. So that's a very good way to do things. I fed you already. And I have some kind of ritual way of feeding the hungry ghost. So I'm going to suggest that we take a few moments in silence now to consider some of the ways that we may already find that we have some kind of grasping or craving, or, you know, we could call it greed, but something unhealthily active in our lives at this time. And just bear witness to it without, you know, feeling any fear or shame or anything like that. You know, non-judgmental bearing witness is very important, because when we do judge, we feed it and strengthen it. So when we just notice it, then we're practicing just the right amount of attention, which leaves us a lot of energy and a lot more of our life force to go into nourishing our whole being. So when we bring just a little bit of attention or awareness to a subject like this, that's like the grain of rice, just a little bit, but it's just the right amount. But that is actually the beginning of our practicing our second great vow, which is that delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. The very beginning of transformation is awareness. So we should know that. It's that worthwhile. If you want to accomplish your vow to transform delusion, to end delusion, it begins by having the willingness to be attentive and aware to what we really are doing. So if you feel comfortable with the idea of working with your attachments now, then we can do this practice together. And if you prefer not to, you can just sit quietly, enjoy your breathing, and you can choose to do it at some other time. No one's forced to do anything. So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes while I take a sip of tea and breathe quietly and very gently, very gently. And without noticing it, just let yourself notice or know one or two ways in which you may have some kind of too strong attachment, some kind of grasping or craving. If it's really strong, you can say greed, it's okay. But just breathe quietly and consider it honestly, but be very gentle and compassionate with yourself. Just noticing is just the right amount. We don't have to delve into it. We don't have to dwell in it. We just have to notice. You can notice how you feel. Is there any resistance or reluctance to know this? Are you making any judgments? Just let yourself honestly touch in and see one or two things that may come under this category in your life. Mind takes you, that's where you need to be looking. And now, keeping your eyes closed and staying with yourself, just leave your bearing witness to this behind. And just come back and follow your breathing. And now we're going to flick the switch. When you feel ready, I'd like you to think of someone who's been kind to you, or someone who's been generous to you in your life. And let yourself feel gratitude for their presence in your life. Could be a partner, spouse, could be a parent, of course, could be a child or a friend or a school teacher or whoever comes to mind, someone who has been generous to you. And generously send your gratitude to them. You can see them in your heart or your mind's eye and say thank you inside yourself. Thank you so much. Doesn't matter if they're living or dead. Makes no difference. And notice how it feels to say thank you. And to generously give. And feeling grateful for the kindness that we've received from other people is a form of generosity. We don't hold it back. And now, maybe think of some people who might need something and how you might be able to help them. Because thinking of the needs of others and coming up with a plan to helping them is a great antidote to greed. You're not thinking of yourself at all. Not sparing the Dharma assets, and actually doing it will change your life. So in this way, we use our practice of generosity, equanimity, and gratitude, and we change, we replace the battle cry of greed, which is what about me, right, to thank you so much, or what does she need, how can I help her, what's his situation, how can I serve him. There's no greed in there. We just flick the switch like that. You know, thinking generously of how to serve other people is a great medicine for when we get too clinging and too attached. And all it takes is flicking the switch and remembering to do it. I'm being driven by this craving. Let's try a little gratitude. Let's try a little generosity. Let's try thinking about how to help somebody. And that craving will stop ruling you. Just like that. Boom. It's really the best of medicines because it brings us back into the balance. A healthy, just the right amount approach to our living. So I sort of think of this as kind of Buddhist jujitsu. Turn greed over and find generosity there. Turn greed over and find gratitude there. Turn greed over and find, I do want to help. And then helping. Isaac Newton, as you know, said that energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only be transformed from one form to another. Greed is just energy. It's a negative kind, a harmful kind of energy. And we have practices that can transform that energy. In a way, the more the greed, the better, because when we turn it over, there's a lot of juice there for helping people, for being generous. And I'd like to ask you to practice this because it is such a simple practice and it is so important. We diminish the suffering because of our greed and the effect it has on us and those around us, and we increase the generosity in the world. We increase the gratitude in the world. We increase the help in the world. Couldn't be more obvious, could it? So we have a few minutes if anybody would like to say anything. Very happy to hear. How was that for you?
We want more.
Well, fortunately you got some. Especially you. It actually is a good point. What if we get greedy about being generous? Well, you know, my son, our youngest, said, I don't really believe that there's anything like pure altruism. He said, I don't believe that. And I said, why not? He said, you're getting something. And I said, you know what? I'll accept that. If you're willing to get one while giving 99, I'll say you're right. But if you're willing to get 99 while you're giving one, then we have to have another conversation. But did you notice how when your mind just stop thinking about your clinging, whatever, and just how you can just switch? It is not hard to do this. It is easy to do this. It's hard to maintain it, which is why we make it a practice. And you might try it every day when you're feeling bound up with that kind of, I gotta, you know. Just take a breath. Think of someone who is nice to you. Be grateful. Look at your life. Be grateful. Think about how to be generous. Let your mind be going in that direction, because that's the direction of the Buddha way. And when we say in the fourth vow, Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it, this is what we're talking about. The conscious choice to move in this direction and not be driven in that direction. Yeah, Heather.
I was going to acknowledge Thay's wisdom, for one thing. And it brings me back to the wheel, giver, receiver, and gift.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, we get something.
Right.
But even when we don't want something, we get the satisfaction and the joy of giving, even if that's 100%.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I'm glad you're saying that, because we get the satisfaction and joy, which sounds personal, right? I get satisfaction, I get joy. But when we feel and express gratitude, and when we act in a way that can be considered generous, and especially when we help, what we're getting is reality, because we're getting connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what it's about. You know, those of you who come on Wednesday nights have heard me say this, but it's not that we are in relationships. We are relationship. Because of the truth of interdependence, all this stuff has constellated as us. You are a living relationship. And greed takes you out of relationship with everything else and only puts you in relationship with the hungry ghost. And so when we counteract it, we come back to reality. We leave the world of delusion, which is the world of greed. Does it make sense to you? And we're doing what we are, which is connection, which, as Dogen would say, is intimacy or non-separation. And that makes you happy because of the connection. Yes, hi. Yeah.
And, you know, if you think of him as Trump.
Yeah. So.
I didn't bring up that very word, but it's true that, you know, what we do, like, we take care of our own greed.
Say it again.
We take care of our own greed.
Yes, right.
Being generous.
Right.
Kind, okay.
Right.
But there's so much greed in the world.
Right.
That it's overwhelming for us with what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Let me answer that this way. Okay? If everyone in the world had decided to not be greedy anymore, would you want to be the last one? No. You'd want to be the first one. So we have to be the first one. Whether or not it changes anything that we can see, the world now has one person who's not greedy. And that's the world. And that's functioning of karma. And that lack of greed in us has an effect. It doesn't wipe out all the greed in the world. But now there's a world where some of that is not happening. And that is very important. As Thich Nhat Hanh told us once in a story, if you were in a boat and the boat is sinking and everyone's going crazy, would you rather be in that boat or in the boat where the boat is sinking and there's one person who can see clearly and help the situation? And of course, that's the boat we want to be in. And the other thing is that with our practice of compassion and awareness, you may not like Donald Trump, but he's part of us. And we have to know that. And so by the way we live our lives, actually, and by saying, no, I don't want to do that. I do want everyone to have health care. That voice becomes very, very important, because it sounds like a voice of opposition. It's actually a voice of affirmation of life. So we want to stand up for life. That's generosity. That's gratitude functioning. And the more it happens, the more things are possible.
That's what I was thinking, Peter, is if you think about what you said about generosity as an antidote, then like it's sort of like infiltration. The more there is, mm-hmm. the more it counteracts the other.
Mm-hmm.
The greed.
Yeah. You know, the thing I miss about Japan the most is bowing. Because you bow about, 1,000 times a day, wherever you go, you're bowing. You just bow. You know? I like that. I like bowing. I think it's good to bow. I think we can never bow enough. I think we should bow all the time. That's my personal view. Why? Because it's a moment when you can leave yourself and join somebody else. Because you do it with people. So I see the clock. I have to stop. Let's chant the four vows.
Page 15.